We are very fortunate to have this episode of Murderific sponsored by Best Fiends.
Hey, are you playing Best Fiends again when you're supposed to be writing the podcast?
I know, but I really needed a break from true crime. And Best Fiends challenges your brain with fun puzzle levels to solve. But it's casual, so it doesn't stress you out, which is exactly what I need right now.
Well, you must really like that game. You play it all the time.
It's a game that anyone can play. It's made for adults. And it's bright, colorful fun, and it's a nice break from the heavy true crime world. I try to get a game in the morning and at night. You can clear boards and unlock and collect new cute bug characters, also known as the Fiends. The game has something new daily and updates the game every month. It's a whole new world right on your phone. So join me and millions of people who are already playing this fun puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Welcome to a true crime murderific journey. I'm your host, Bernadette. Stay tuned after the show for promos, patron shoutouts, and phone calls. Remember, horrific and murder equals murderific. Enjoy the show.
Content warning. The Murderific True Crime Podcast contains offensive language and will have information about kidnappings, torture, murder, and sexual assault. It is inappropriate for children or the faint of heart.
Sheriff Jim Jenkins remembers the case well. He and another deputy were called to Spring Hill and Canal Roads in response to a stabbing. Once there, they found a man in his underwear, bound at the wrists and ankles, a stab wound in his chest. Larry Eiler showed up at the scene moments later. Eiler explained that he and the man were playing out one of Eiler's sexual fantasies. Eiler was armed with a 10-inch Bowie knife during the encounter.
I believe his words were that he forgot he had a knife in his hand and he pushed this boy. And when he pushed him, he stabbed him.
The man never pressed charges against Eiler. Jenkins says he was too embarrassed.
Known by names like the Interstate Killer, Highway Killer, Larry William Eiler murdered a minimum of 20 to 25 men across five states from 1982 to 1984. He also had an accomplice for some of his torture murders. Larry Eiler would lure male victims with promises of drugs or alcohol or money and then murder them in unimaginable brutal ways. In a shocking turn of events, Larry was arrested and released due to police negligence and was then able to continue killing young men. This is a big story and will be presented in two episodes over 2 weeks. This is part one, episode 47 of Murderific True Crime Podcast. And as always, here's another warning. Today's show will have very explicit, dark, gruesome content, but I imagine that's why you're here. Stay tuned to the end for a promo by Excuse Me, That's a Legal Podcast. All right, let's get started at the beginning. Larry William Eiler was born December 21st, 1952, in Crawfordsville, Indiana. His parents were George Howard Eiler and Shirley Phyllis Kennedy. Larry was the youngest of four children. Larry's father was an alcoholic and emotionally and physically abused his wife and children. His parents divorced by the time Larry was two, and Larry stayed with his mother. Being a single mother, Shirley really struggled to support her kids. She had to work multiple jobs, waitress work, factory work, and at a bar on weekends. Because of this, Larry and his younger sister were mostly left in the care of the older two siblings. And by older, the oldest was only 10 years old. They had many babysitters, and they were left with family, and many times Larry would actually be put in foster care. While in foster care, his mom always would go visit him when she had a chance. So his mom was really struggling financially just to support the family and could barely keep it together. Larry went to St. Joseph's School in Lebanon, Indiana. In school, Larry was bullied due to being poor and not having his biological dad around. He was very tall and played sports. He had a few friends, and his teachers said he was a likable but very quiet student. In 1957, Larry was 4 years old, and his mother remarried. This marriage only lasted 1 year. In 1960, Larry's mom remarried for the third time, and again divorced 4 years later. By 1972, Shirley had married for the fourth time. During this very important time in a young boy's life, all of Larry's stepfathers subjected him to much physical abuse, along with his other siblings. One of the stepfathers would discipline Eiler by forcing his head and face under boiling hot water. His mother also had many different boyfriends coming in and out of the home at the time. All of this being moved around and the physical and emotional abuse really caused issues in Larry's short life, causing him to act out, and he began to be stubborn and erratic. By age 10, he was put in a home for unruly boys, which was very upsetting for Larry. Soon he was back home with his mother, but she had him take a psychological evaluation in a child's clinic. These tests showed average IQ, but that Larry suffered from very severe anxiety, and he was terrified of separation and abandonment, and that he had ongoing trauma from the foster care, the stepfather abuse, his mother's marriages. This child clinic believed that Larry's home life was not safe and was very unstable. And then he was put in a Catholic boys' home for 6 months in Fort Wayne, Indiana, but he then returned home to his mom. As a teenager, Larry knew that he was gay, and he really struggled personally with this. He made a big effort to appear masculine to others. Larry dropped out of high school, but did eventually get his GED. He did go to college sporadically, so he never got a degree in college. Larry worked odd jobs and low-paying jobs. He even joined a monastery for a very short time. Still, Larry was having a hard time with the fact that he was gay. He admitted his feelings to friends. It excited and repelled him at the same time. He was very confused by the fact. Larry began to go to gay bars and fell into the leather fetish type of groups. People described Larry as laid back and friendly, but as soon as he was involved in a sexual act with another man, his personality would change. Some of Larry's old lovers would say that they were choked or beaten during sex. They were also called whore or bitch, and Larry would yell profanities at them, even using a knife to lightly cut their torsos. Several men said Larry would not look at them in the eyes during sex. Larry's family knew that he was a homosexual, and eventually he became open to them about it. Larry was around 20 years old at this point, and he met a 38-year-old man named Robert Little, who was a professor at Indiana State University. They were friends, but Larry really looked up to Little as a father figure. Larry moved into the condo at Terre Haute with Robert. The two would go meet men at gay bars together, but Little was awkward and unattractive, so Larry would sometimes get young men for both of them to have sex with. And things start escalating pretty quick right now. On August 3rd, 1978, Larry picked up 19-year-old ex-Marine Craig Long on 7th Street in Terre Haute. Craig was hitchhiking. When Larry came on to Craig sexually, Craig tried to leave the vehicle. Larry put a knife up to Craig's chest and brought him to a rural field where he forced him to undress. Then he handcuffed Craig and tied up his ankles. As Larry started to take his clothes off, Craig saw his chance and ran. Larry chased him, calling him a queer, and then stabbed the victim in the chest, and the knife went into Craig's lung, and this was an 8-inch butcher knife. Craig fell to the ground and pretended that he was dead. He managed to make his way to a nearby home, and 911 was called. Craig had been drugged and beaten also. He was naked, and his wound required 36 stitches. And weirdly enough, Larry went back to the house where Craig was receiving first aid, and he gave the sheriff there the handcuff key to unlock the handcuffs left on the victim. Larry explained that he had accidentally stabbed Craig. Larry was arrested and his truck was searched, finding whips, hunting knives, more handcuffs, and a sword and tear gas. I have to say, for a first crime, I believe this is very brutal, so this is probably the first crime he got caught committing. Larry was charged with battery, and his bond was $10,000, which friends raised for him, Larry was out free August 23, 1978. And at that date, Larry's father figure, Robert Little, paid the victim $2,500 so that he would not press charges against Larry. Charges were dropped, and Larry was acquitted November 13th and was fined $43 in court costs. Soon after, in 1981, Larry Eiler met another man named John Dubrovolsky. Excuse me if I pronounced that wrong. John was married and had children, but John's wife Sally knew her husband was gay and even allowed Larry to live in their family home on weekends. John and Larry had a romantic sexual relationship. They lived in Chicago, Illinois. John, his wife, two kids, three foster kids, and Larry. John and Larry did not want to be monogamous, though they were committed to each other. Larry was very jealous of John, though, when he had affairs. Occasionally, John would hit Larry during fights, and Larry would never fight back. They both enjoyed masochistic sex with each other. Larry's other boyfriend, the older Robert Little, despised John and resented the fact that Larry was in another committed relationship. And that's how it went. Larry would spend weekends with Robert Little in Indiana, where he was working at a liquor store, and weekends with his lover, John, in Illinois. And Larry would paint houses on the weekends. He lived rent-free with Robert and paid a third of the rent at John's house. Larry's sadistic sexual desires, though, could not be filled by consensual sex, though, even with two partners and other occasional lovers. So Larry took the next step. Soon male bodies began to be found along highways and fields, usually naked and beaten in the worst of ways, and also usually missing their wallets. Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience, no matter what size. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And be sure to add our podcast in the How Did You Hear About Podgo section of the application. 4 years after the stabbing of Craig Long, who got away from Larry, in March of 1982, Jay Reynolds was found stabbed to death in the outskirts of Lexington, Kentucky. He is a possible victim of Larry Eiler. On October 2, 1982, Delvoid Baker, age 14, was strangled and found on the side of a road north of Indianapolis, Indiana. October 23, 1982, Larry Eiler kidnapped 19-year-old Stephen Crockett. He was found in a cornfield in an Illinois county about 12 hours after the murder happened. The autopsy showed that Stephen was beaten extensively, then stabbed 32 times, which includes the 4 stabs to his head. I'm going to apologize if I get anything wrong. In many of my sources, some names and dates are actually wrong and switched around, and it was very hard to find the correct info because some names and dates were just wrong in the sources. Also, there are questions about who all Larry's victims were. Some will list 21, some say many more. So I'm going to try to be as factual as I can. October 30, 1982, less than a week after the last murder, a 26-year-old named Edgar Underkoffler went missing from Illinois. He wouldn't be discovered until March 4, 1983, in a field close to Danville, Illinois. He was found stabbed to death. His shoes and socks had been taken, but new tube socks the victim did not own were on his feet. On November 4, 1982, Craig Townsend was drugged and beaten by Larry Eilers and tortured near Lowell, Indiana. He managed to escape and he went to the hospital. Unfortunately, Craig left the hospital before authorities could finish their investigation. That same exact day, November 4, 1982, that Craig got away from Larry, Larry found another victim in Robert Foley. Robert was left in a field outside of Joliet, Illinois. Christmas of 82, the body of 25-year-old John Johnson, who worked in a bar, was found dumped in a field outside of Belshaw, Indiana. He would not be found until a month later. Also in the same month, December of 1982, 23-year-old Stephen Agin was kidnapped from Terre Haute. He was about to go to college. Stephen would be found December 28, 1982, off of State Road 63. The authorities looked at the outbuilding of an abandoned farm very close to where they had found Stephen. While authorities were searching around where they found Stephen, they looked at an outbuilding of an abandoned farm, and they found traces of nails being scratched on the walls. They found human flesh on the walls. They believed that Stephen had been suspended up, maybe from the ceiling, so that the assailant could beat Stephen. There was extensive mutilation on Stephen's stomach, horizontal cuts on his throat and chest. He had rope around his ankles. The doctor who performed the autopsy mentioned, quote, tremendous rage, unquote, in the attack. He also mentioned in his notes in the report, maybe there was more than one murderer at this crime scene. And we continue with more murders. The same man who conducted Stephen Agin's autopsy did the autopsy of John Roach, another 21-year-old victim from the month of December 82, found close by to Agin. He noticed, as he said, quote, striking similarities, unquote, in the injuries of both men, noticing multiple stab wounds again to the stomach, chest, and throat, showing excessive rage from the killer. John Roach had went missing December 22 of 1982, and he was found near Interstate 70. Both these victims, John Roach and Stephen, were found on the same day. December 30th, 1982, 22-year-old David Block, who was a Yale University graduate, told his family he was going to visit a friend in the town of Highwood. He went missing and wouldn't be found until May 7th of 1984. By a farmer in Illinois near Route 173. He had wounds similar to all of the other victims. With dead bodies showing up in Indiana and Illinois, police finally started making a connection, and eventually a task force was created to try to stop the murders. Police believed transient street hustlers were most at risk due to the victim that they believed they were seeing. But I want to stress that while some of the victims were homosexual, not all of them were, despite what the police believed. There were black men, there were white men, there were straight men, there were homosexual men. Larry Eiler was a very skilled con man who didn't really look scary. He was charming and manipulative, and people were just more trusting back in the early 1980s. The task force believed that all of these crimes were by the same person. They believed the perpetrator was at war with his own sexuality, and that he was a white male in his 20s and worked in some sort of menial profession. Maybe he enjoyed the sexual encounters, but the shame was so much that he had to kill his victims. The police also believed that the offender would go to redneck bars, and they also believed that he would try to appear masculine or have a macho image. Police now knew without a doubt that they had a serial killer targeting men throughout Illinois and Indiana, though they did not say this publicly. Which brings us right up to 1983 with a sadistic killer on the loose. And this is where we will end part one, episode 47, on Larry Eilers. I will be back next Sunday with part two. Thank you for listening. And keep listening because we're going to have a murderific map minute, where I will discuss other killers that were active around the same time frame as this episode in the 1980s in the Midwest United States. All right, guys, it's Murderific Map Minute time. As we know, Larry had many victims still not identified across many state lines. Who else was operating as a serial killer in this same time frame and close by to Indiana and Illinois? Henry Lee Lucas, a convicted serial killer who has admitted to up to 360 murders, May have murdered 31 people in Illinois alone. Henry Lucas and Otis Toole met at a soup kitchen in 1976 and began a sexual relationship. Soon they were drifting across the country, kidnapping and raping and murdering men and women in the early 80s. Also in Indiana, Howard Allen, a serial killer who operated there from the late 70s to 80s, he murdered three elderly women that we know of, using blunt force, trauma, and stabbing. He also robbed them, which may have been his ultimate motive. And if we're in Indiana, we have to mention Herb Baumeister, who was responsible for the murder of at least 11 victims that were found on a property in Westfield, Indiana. Most of Herb's victims were gay men who were murdered during sexual acts and drugged and strangled. Herb is also suspected of many more deaths. He is believed to be the I-70 strangler from Indiana and Ohio. In all, Herb may have killed up to 30 people from 1980 to 96. To me, it's very terrifying that this is only three people that were operating in the same time frame and the same states. So how scary is that? I do want to mention and give thanks to my executive producers, Mike T, Jamie S, Beth Ann L, and Christina B. I want to welcome my new patron this week, Casey J from Australia. And I want to say thank you to Fiona S and Karen T, who went on buymeacoffee.com and bought me some coffees. And I went to Aroma Joe's and had a Frojo and was bouncing off the walls. So anyways, thank you for that. I want to thank my longtime supporters on Patreon, Kaylee Lyons, Ainsley V, and also Diana AQ, and Murderous Miners, who has been one of my patrons from the very beginning. Her podcast is amazing. And again, stay tuned for the promo coming up, Excuse Me, That's Illegal, by Leroy Luna. I will see you for part two next week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Murderific True Crime Podcast. To support the show, join our Patreon and hear the regular podcast early and ad-free. Plus get some fun merch or buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com. You can find both of those links in our show notes or at murderific.com. Of course, you can rate and review Murderific on iTunes, which is free and an easy way to help others find the show. Or tell your friends, it really helps. All sources for episodes will be in the show notes. Until next time, we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
Craving this awful, raging, eating feeling inside. I could feel it consuming my inside, this fantastic passion. It was overwhelming me.
Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know. Who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as the Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal, is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me.
I'll be right here waiting for you.